Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Lauren Cordain as my special expert guest. Lauren Cordain, PhD, is a professor in the Department of Health and Exercise Science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. His research emphasis over the past 15 years has focused on the evolutionary and anthropological basis for diet, health, and well-being in modern humans. Dr. Cordain's scientific publications have examined the nutritional characteristics of worldwide hunter-gatherer diets, as well as the nutrient composition of wild plant and animal foods consumed by foraging humans. Over the past 5 years, his work has focused on the adverse health effects of the high dietary glycemic load common to the Western diet. Dr. Cordain is the author of more than 100 peer-reviewed publications. He is the recent recipient of the Scholarly Excellence Award at Colorado State University for his contributions into understanding optimal human nutrition. He has lectured extensively on the Paleolithic nutrition concept worldwide and has also written three popular books, The Paleo Diet, The Paleo Diet for Athletes, and The Dietary Cure for Acne. Good morning, Dr. Cordain. Welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good morning, Corey. It's my pleasure to be here and give you my interview.
Fantastic. I'm very excited to speak with you because I read your book and was intrigued by a lot of the data and the research that you have extensive knowledge in. But when did you first develop your interest in Paleolithic nutrition, Lauren?
Oh, boy. You know, I've always been interested in health and well-being and nutrition throughout most of my life. But I read Boyd Eaton's seminal paper in the New England Journal of Medicine that was published in 1984 or 5. I think I got around to reading it in the late 80s, so it must have been 88 or 89. And that's what really spurred my interest in this Paleolithic diet concept. So I have to attribute Boyd Eaton as my mentor and kind of getting me involved in this whole concept. So probably the late 80s, early 90s.
Now, can you tell us what Paleolithic actually means for those of us that are not familiar with that term?
Sure. Paleo means old and lithic means stone. So Paleolithic is the old stone age. And the old stone age is the period in which humans used just stone tools. They hadn't invented metal tools. And that dates back to 10,000 years to 2.4 million years ago when the first stone tools were made. So 2.4 million years ago until 10,000 years ago is basically when the Paleolithic era lasted.
Now, a lot of us that were raised in the school system are familiar with the evolutionary concept, but none of us were given any insider information about what these people actually ate and then correlated that to our present way of eating. So based on your research, what do you think is the optimum way to eat? Like, what's the ideal diet for the human species, the modern humans of today?
Well, I think the notion that what we are supposed to eat is what we're genetically programmed to eat is a fairly recent idea, although you can go all the way back to Rousseau and some of the French philosophers stating that humans should eat in an unadulterated manner. So I think the basic concept of eating as our ancestors, as non-Westernized, non-civilized people ate, is fairly old, but the scientific aspects of this are relatively recent, and some anthropologists have been involved with it. As I mentioned, my mentor and colleague Boyd Eaton published that seminal paper in the 1980s, which really got everybody involved, and I have done work over the last two decades kind of taking off where Boyd started. But the real notion is that humans are no different than any other animals and that we should be eating the foods that we're genetically programmed to eat, and these are the foods that are found in the native human ecologic niche, and that native human ecologic niche is one of a hunter-gatherer. And so virtually every person on the planet was a hunter-gatherer 10,000 years ago. So the types of foods that they hunted and gathered, the wild plant and animal foods, were the foods that really shaped our genome, and these are the foods that we're genetically adapted to. So in a nutshell, we recommend that humans try to emulate basic nutritional characteristics of our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Clearly, we can't eat in the exact manner that they ate, and there was no single Stone Age diet, but there were certain universal characteristics, and these universal characteristics were freshly harvested wild plant and animal foods. They rarely, if ever, ate cereal grains. Obviously, they hadn't domesticated animals, so they couldn't eat dairy foods. And processed foods that are mixtures of grains and sugars and processed oils and salts and so forth simply did not exist. So the types of foods that we are recommending are fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, lean meats, and seafood. And we believe that these foods form the basic of modern-day paleo analog diets of what our ancestors ate.
Now, you're speaking as a scientist in scientific terms, and it makes perfect sense. And I've got three kids, and they all learned about mathematics and English from a scientific point of view. But when it comes to nutrition, why isn't the science of nutrition taught the way that you're speaking to in this the education system and practiced? Like, for example, why in the school cafeteria do they serve refined food, or in hospitals? Like, if this is a science that makes perfect genetic sense, why isn't this mainstream consciousness, and why do so few people understand this?
Well, I think part of it is simply ignorance of the data and the facts. Most people are unaware or have not given much thought to the notion of what is the basis for our dietary requirements. I mean, clearly, the basis for our dietary requirements are genetically based, and our genetics are based upon evolution and natural selection. So most anthropologists, these concepts are fairly common, but most physicians and most nutritionists don't have anthropology backgrounds. And so I think it's like any other tool in science, be it a computer or math or physics or any other a tool that we use to solve problems, is that we should use all available tools, i.e. all available knowledge bases, to help us solve problems. And when we look at nutrition, nutrition is biology, and the underlying discipline in all of biology is evolution through natural selection. And so it's only obvious that we should be using this tool to help us deal with complex health diet-related problems. And so the real dawn of this evolutionary medicine has only been since the early 90s. And so as obvious as it may be after the fact, after somebody has pointed it out, it still takes a while to get into the mainstream consciousness. And I think more and more nutritional scientists are becoming aware of and realizing the evolutionary base for our diet. And through publications that I've done and my colleagues, this is becoming more and more of a household term, and it's virtually undeniable. I didn't invent this, and it doesn't require a charismatic individual to promote it. What we did is we simply uncovered what was already there. We simply uncovered the types of diets that humans have always eaten and are genetically programmed to eat, and the range of diets they're programmed to eat. And I think that's the real beauty of it, is the simplicity of it. And when you have something right in a network of human individuals, when somebody gets the correct answer to a question or a problem, in a network of individuals, ultimately everybody gets the correct answer. And I think that in nutrition, we have come up with the correct answers along with many other people. And 100 years from now, I don't think that this will be revolutionary at all. It will be the basis by which everybody looks at human nutrition.
When you see the way people eat today, mainstream eating, and then correlate that with how you know they should be eating, and then look at the medical statistics, you know, with obesity and vascular disease, in your head, are you thinking that the reason that so many of us have so many health problems is because we're not following the science? Is that how you see it?
Well, I think the science is fractionated, and I think the average consumer is, you know, one day you're supposed to eat cholesterol or eggs, one day eggs are good, the next day they're bad, one day pizza's good, the next day they're bad. And so I think the average consumer is confused, and they don't have this unifying template of evolution to help guide them to what they should eat. So, eating is also a vast behavioral issue, is that people eat for many reasons besides eating for health. People eat for many, many reasons. They eat what tastes good. They eat when they're depressed. They eat when they're happy. They're celebrating. So there's this huge psychological area that we deal with when we deal with food consumption. And I think many people consciously know the healthy foods, but they don't eat them because they don't like them. If you go to somebody's party and they put out a tray of broccoli and carrots and there's some salty nuts or some fatty meats or some sugary treats, people tend to eat what tastes good at the moment. And I don't think that everybody consciously eats for health and well-being. Now, people that are sick, that are very, very ill, will do that. But many people won't. And they'll eat right up to the point where they've basically dug their grave with their teeth. So there's multiple issues here when we talk about what is healthy and why people eat what they eat.
When we talk about how food influences how our genes express themselves, can you tell us what that actually means? Because the average person thinks you eat food, you swallow it, you digest it, you absorb it. They don't get how that can affect how our genes are being expressed.
Well, that's right. I mean, our genes are being expressed every single day. Multiple thousands and thousands of genes are being expressed, and the expression of genes are influenced by our environment. I mean, when you injure yourself and you have an injury to your tissue, the injury causes multiple genes to be expressed for this inflammatory response and to cause healing to occur. What is less frequently appreciated is that when we eat foods, specific food types actually turn on and turn off genes. And so we have known of this for a number of decades, and we know that the types of foods that we eat influence our behavior. They influence how we feel, whether we're depressed. They influence whether we're going to get disease. They influence how long we live. They influence skin tone, hair color, everything. So this is a notion that most scientists are aware of, but indeed, foods do influence which genes are turned on and which ones aren't.
Now, I've read your book, The Paleo Diet for Athletes, and I've recommended it to all of my students. It's a great read. But how does this book differ from other diet books written for athletes?
Well, my co-author on this book is Joe Friel, and he's the U.S. Olympic, or he was the U.S. Olympic triathlete coach. He continues to coach many world-class athletes. And I've known Joe for almost 30 years. He was here in Fort Collins. He owned a running shoe store back in the early 80s, and he and I got to know one another because we're both runners. And Joe had eaten in a traditional manner most of his life, the way most endurance athletes do, a diet that is very high in starch and carbohydrates, very low in red meats, and emphasizing starches and carbohydrates so that the muscle glycogen stores could be replenished. And the common wisdom, I think, for the last 30 years was that endurance athletes and athletes in general particularly needed a much higher carbohydrate diet so that they could replenish muscle glycogen stores so that they could do their endurance thing. And this type of a diet was at the expense of healthy, fresh fruits and vegetables and meats. And so many endurance athletes avidly avoided red meat and meats in general. And what Joe found was when he himself adopted this diet back in the early 90s, is that his performance, and he was a world-class athlete at the time, a world-class senior master's level athlete, he found that his performance actually improved, and he documented it in our book. And he has since recommended the diet to multiple world international class athletes as well as armchair athletes, and he's found that the diet tends to improve their performance for a number of reasons, one of which is that when they start eating meat again, many of them who are anemic and deficient in zinc and vitamin B6, those deficiencies are eliminated, also when they reduce their intake of refined carbohydrates, white flours and sugars and potatoes and such that they use to keep these high starch diets going. They eat more and more fresh fruits and vegetables. They increase their vitamin and mineral and phytonutrient intake, and their general health and overall performance increases. So what's unusual is that we're just stating the obvious, is that athletes, like anybody else, need to have a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables and meats, and to reduce the intake of refined carbs like spaghettis and white breads and pastas and so forth, which they thrived on before, but their performance didn't thrive.
Now, what about this as an argument against what you've said? We look at the Stone Age diet, the hunting-gathering diet, and we can see and understand what they ate, but these people weren't running marathons. They weren't Ironman triathletes. So how do you respond to that? Because we just recently did some seminars in Utah, and you know that it's a very strong running triathlete community, and a lot of these runners and athletes, Lauren, were struggling with excess body fat, even though they were training 4 to 6 hours a day. And I'd like you to maybe take a shot at why they were struggling with body fat. But are you saying that we shouldn't eat any grains as long-distance runners?
Absolutely not. You know, I think this is what Joe is just a master of the practical. He kind of took my idea with a Stone Age diet, and he was able to make it work for world-class athletes. And we've never said that world-class and endurance athletes don't need to be glycogen replete. In other words, they need to have their glycogen stores maximized before an event. And in our book, we describe how that can be done, but we describe how it can be done in a more healthful manner than the way in which most endurance athletes do it, by eating grains and refined sugars. One of the aspects to getting muscle glycogen restored so that you can go out day after day and run these, you know, 100-mile weeks and beyond, is to eat the appropriate carbohydrate in the post-exercise period. And one of the factors that had not been considered until publication of our book was the notion of acid-base balance. And what we are suggesting is that athletes use carbohydrate-rich foods that yield a net alkaline or base source to restore their muscle glycogen. These would be sweet potatoes, yams, fruits, fruit juices, and certain athletic drinks that we recommend in our book. And so we think that athletes can still eat carbohydrates, but they can eat them in a manner that is much more healthful. Grains and sugars and so forth produce those types of processed foods that athletes eat are net acid yielding. And we know that net acid yielding foods actually take away from the body. They require a certain amino acid, glutamine, in order to be metabolized. And so the loss of glutamine then, we believe, is potentially degrading on the muscle. And so by using foods that are net base yielding in the post-exercise period, along with protein, not only can you restore muscle glycogen, but you can have an anabolic effect on muscle if the protein is taken in that short window following the exercise period. So, yeah, to answer your question, we're not saying that athletes shouldn't have carbs. They absolutely need carbs, but they need the right kind of carbs. And many athletes do gain weight on the typical athletic diet because of its high glycemic load, which tends to knock their insulin metabolism into a bad way, which tends to promote weight gain.
What do you think about some of these ancient grains like quinoa and amaranth and spelt? Do you think that they're better choices than the new versions of wheat?
Well, you know, all of these grains are still net acid yielding. They still yield a high net glycemic load. And compared to tubers that are net base yielding, we think that the athlete is much better off eating net base yielding carbs that are rapidly assimilated, like they can get from yams, sweet potatoes, fruits, dried fruits and fruit juices and certain athletic drinks, as opposed to pounding down starches and spaghettis and pastas.
That's an excellent point. Now, what about commercial meat versus bison or elk or wild game? Do you think there's a difference?
Well, you know, we've published a couple of papers, and all of those publications are available at my website, www.thepaleodiet.com. And so you can see the science that we've written on this. And you're absolutely right, is that pasture-fed or free free-ranging animals have a much healthier fatty acid profile than do animals that are raised in a livestock setting. The omega-3 content of grass-fed and free-ranging animals is higher. There's less saturated fat. There's more protein. And those are really the big issues, is the saturated fat, the protein, and the omega-3 content.
Now, when I read your book, I thought, aha, this is good stuff, because this is basically how I've been eating and thinking for a long time myself. It just makes perfect sense. And I work in an environment where there's a lot of vegans and vegetarians that, you know, shop at health food stores and come to seminars and things, and you know how critical they are of eating meat. So how do you defend your position with everything that they will throw at you when they say that, you know, that meat is, you know, cancer promoting and it generates net acids and, you know, yada, yada, yada. They will go on to the point where ad nauseum, where they just don't believe that any animal foods of any kind are required to optimize health. What's your position on that?
You know, it's in a half-hour interview, it's really impossible for me to go into the kind of detail I need to go into. But for your students and your listeners, if they go online, I did a debate, and you can probably Google this and pull it up. It's called The Great Protein Debate. Type that in with my name. And another fellow at Cornell, a past chairman of the nutrition department there, T. Colin Campbell, who wrote a book called The China Project. And he's an avid vegetarian, vegan vegetarian. And so we had this online debate, and it came out as a series of papers amounting to about 10,000 words, you know, 20 or 30 pages. And so your readers can download that and really get all the information. But the bottom line is that if your major concern is to eat for performance or to improve your health, there's no doubt that a paleo way of eating is superior to a vegan way of eating. And humans have been eating meat. It's been part of our diet for over 2.5 million years. So in terms of, you know, specifics, I could get into that. But again, I don't know if we want to do that. But many vegan athletes and vegan, they become anemic. They become zinc deficient because they're not eating meats. Unless they're supplementing their diet, they probably have low intake of omega-3 fatty acids. The vitamin B12 issue is certainly important. Zinc, it's almost impossible to get your adequate zinc intake on a vegan diet. A vegan diet is based on grains and beans. Many vegans eat an enormous amount of whole grains and beans, and we know from studies from our laboratories that whole grains and legumes are one of the richest sources of anti-nutrients called lectins, and we believe that lectins have multiple adverse health effects. And so many vegans and vegetarians, if they switch over from the average American diet, they seem to do well within the first year or two. They lose weight. They maybe have increases in energy and so forth. But if you follow them, you know, devoted vegans over 5, 10, 15 years, most of them don't do well at all. They have many health issues, dry skin, brittle hair, compromised immune systems, joint problems, aches, pains. They simply don't do very well at all. And what we found is that reformed vegans and vegetarians, when they shift back over to eating meat, they do much, much better. But there's a healthful way of doing it, and that's much different than the way it's done in the average American diet. And the healthful way of eating meat is the way we describe eating meat in a Stone Age or a Paleolithic manner.
Now, you mentioned that you are a runner, Lorne, and I've seen a photograph of you. You look like you're more ectomorphic. Is that true? You are naturally lean?
I'm fairly lean. I would say I'm probably mesomorphic more than ecto. And if you see me in ecto, that might be in a frantic phase in my life when you know, there's a lot of stress going on. But I would say I'm probably mesomorphic on a personal level.
Okay, so can you give us an idea of what you actually eat in, say, any given day from the principles based on what you teach? What are your meals like, and what do they consist of?
Sure. You know, typically the breakfast meal is a little bit of leftover of what we had the night before. For instance, let's see, for breakfast this morning we had broiled salmon, and so I had a little bit of leftover broiled salmon and then whatever fresh fruit is in season. And I try to focus on berries. Berries are very rich in antioxidants, and they have low glycemic loads and low glycemic indices. Some people that are overweight and obese need to be careful about eating a lot of fruit, particularly when they first adopt this diet. So fruit can be problematic for some folks, particularly real high glycemic loads that give you a lot of sugar, like grapes and so forth. But berries are always a good choice, and as are melons. Melons tend to have low glycemic loads. So breakfast is usually a little bit of what's left over from the night before, almost always fish or meat of some sort. And I always eat until I'm full. I don't deliberately try to undereat or overeat. I just eat until I'm comfortable, and then I'm pretty much, that's it. I typically don't eat lunch. My energy levels tend to be high throughout the day. And then for dinner, we have three children, three boys, three teenage boys, and we almost always have a main dish that is some sort of meat, roast, whatever. We almost, if we can, we like to get wild game or grass-fed beef or fish that's not farm-raised. And then we have steamed vegetables, broccoli, a huge salad, a couple steamed vegetables, some fruit. And for the teenage kids, we might have some net base yielding higher glycemic load carbs, as mentioned earlier, potatoes, sweet potatoes, yams. With our children, we are not, forceful with this. They have the option of eating what they want, but they typically choose the healthier foods.
I was going to ask you about that, because a lot of our students and members are parents with children, and sports nutrition for kids is a big factor. Now, what about all these athletic kids, playing sports in America? Do you think that what you're promoting is a better alternative than what they're currently consuming and eating like?
We don't really have any experience, and I hate to overstate any claim without scientific, data to back it up. We have some pretty good data with adults showing that adults and athletes in their prime do better by eating the way in which we advocate, by eating more lean meats, by getting their iron and their zinc intake up, by eating more fresh fruits and vegetables, and by utilizing net base yielding carbohydrates to ensure that they have adequate muscle glycogen stores. I think that eating, is, as we mentioned earlier, there's a behavioral aspect to eating besides just the functional aspect. We don't just eat to produce world-class athletes. We don't just eat because we're trying to maximize our health. Clearly, it's part of it. And I think the same thing is true with children, and it's like politics or religion. I don't think you should force adult belief systems on children. You should expose the children to those, and then hopefully the children will make the correct choice. Because when you force belief systems on children, the first thing they do is, when the parents are away, they turn around and they do the exact opposite. And so from a psychological perspective, I think it's a lot healthier to provide the children with healthy foods at every meal and have them hopefully make healthy choices. And so that would be my recommendation for parents, is to have the healthful foods at all meals, to have steamed vegetables, to have salads, to have meats, and if they're going to have pizza or the other tacos or whatever food they're going to have, try to make healthier versions of those. It's possible to do that, but to have to allow the child to make the choice themselves, or the teenager.
Again, another great point and a great observation. I know that will help, because raising kids today tends to be somewhat of a stressful situation, to say the least, especially when it comes to diet and nutrition. I've heard so many parents, Lauren, come at me and just say, I just can't get my kids' diet in order. They scream and yell for their breakfast cereals, and they're guided by the television, et cetera. So
part of it is what you stock your house with, and we simply don't have cereals in our house. So, there is no choice there. it's not like we don't stock any processed food, but we just don't stock the really bad stuff. And the children know when it's a treat. If they're going to have a pizza, once in a blue moon, or, ice cream with whatever, it's like, that is a treat, but it's not the norm. And, I think that then they can make those decisions for themselves.
Now, you mentioned high glycemic carbs. I think more people are familiar with that idea or that notion, but less is known about what you also said, glycemic load. So what do you mean by glycemic load?
Well, this is a concept that my two colleagues came up with. Jenny Brand Miller, she's a co-author of mine at the University of Sydney, and David Jenkins at Toronto. And David actually came up with the concept of a glycemic index. And that's simply how much, when you eat a food, how much it spikes your blood sugar, how much it raises your blood sugar. And that was a pretty good idea in that it helped to give us a notion of that not all starches were the same, because we used to talk about refined sugars and compare them to starches, like white sugar versus a potato, and now we and in white bread and so forth. Now we know that potato has a starch in it that elevates our blood sugar similar to sugars. And so that was a good notion in that we were able to define that. And we got a handle on this by the mid-1990s. Jenny Brand-Miller at University of Sydney started to categorize this and published the glycemic indices of various foods. And then in 1997, the group at Harvard came up with the notion of a glycemic load. And that really leveled the playing field, because what the glycemic load did, it took the glycemic index and it multiplied the carbohydrate content of an average food serving by the glycemic index, so that we could see how much a serving of food actually influenced our blood sugar level. So not all nutritionists agree that the glycemic load is superior to the glycemic index. I personally subscribe to that notion, and I think that it's important that that people who are trying to improve their diet try to reduce the glycemic load, because we know that a high glycemic load diet influences our endocrine or our hormonal function in a manner that is generally not healthful the higher the glycemic load.
Are you familiar with any evidence regarding the impact, referring to glycemic load, of, say, commercial meat versus wild game? I've heard some experts talk about the distortion of lysine and arginine levels that are changing because of how the animals are fed, and that some of these newer types of proteins actually have the same impact as sugar on blood chemistry. Are you familiar with that?
You know, it's an interesting notion. I am really unfamiliar with any publications regarding that, but I can tell you that when you eat lean meats or any kind of meat per se, there is virtually no carbohydrate in meat, and there is a glycemic response. The blood sugar does go up, as does the insulin concentration, but not nearly as high as it does with carbohydrate-containing foods. And the reason that you have a glycemic and an insulin response to protein is because there are two gut hormones, GLP and GIP, that are released when those proteins are degraded into their constituent amino acids. And so, as you mentioned, the amino acid profile of the protein that is broken down influences the glycemic and insulinemic response. And various amino acids yield a higher glycemic response. And we've done work here in our laboratory showing that the amino acid profile in milk actually is more insulinemic and more glycemic than what you would find in beef. Now, in terms of grass versus grain-fed beef, I haven't read anything to indicate that. I would be very much surprised to see much of a difference, simply because the types of proteins, actin and myosin, that we find in either wild animals or domestic animals are essentially the same. So I'd be surprised to see if the amino acid profile was much different. But it's an interesting point.
Right on. That's excellent. And I'll ask you one more question, because we're running out of time here. I know you've written a new book about skin and acne. And the first thing that I thought of is, my goodness, for most of my life, I've been told by medical doctors that diet has absolutely nothing to do with acne or eczema, and you've heard this before. Can you give us your position on how they respond to that?
Well, I'll tell you what, Corey, you and I must be about the same age, because that's what I heard all of my life, too. you know, I finally got around to reading the scientific literature to see where the dermatologists had picked up on this idea, and it turns out there was only two published papers, one that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 1971, and then one prior to that, 1969. So those articles are, you know, they're, what, 35 years old or older, and the science behind them was awful. So we went back, and I teach a research design class at a Division I university, and we looked at these studies, and I use them as archetypical examples of horrible research design. So there were holes in the design of both studies that were big enough to drive a Mack truck through. And when I realized that, I read this about a decade ago, I thought, there's no good evidence one way or the other to show whether or not acne is involved with diet. And so what we did is we ended up doing a couple of epidemiologic studies. We went down to a remote island off the coast of Papua New Guinea, and we surveyed almost 1,300 people on the Catawan Islands, and we found out that these islanders, including over 300 teenagers, there was absolutely zero acne in this group. And we took a different approach and went to the jungles of South America. We studied the Ashe hunter-gatherers from Paraguay, and we followed them over a two-year period, including a group of about 20 teenagers. And we didn't find a single zit in any of these groups at any time. In the U.S., acne afflicts roughly 90% of the teenage population. So that just immediately, bingo, we realized that there had to be something environmentally that was going on. And environmentally, diet seemed to be the logical point. So we went through the biochemistry of and molecular biology of what causes acne, and we were able to pinpoint a number of key hormones that adversely influence acne that are affected by diet. And so the upshot of the whole deal was, as my colleague Neil Mann at Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Australia, did a three-year randomized controlled trial of diet and acne, and lo and behold, he showed that teenagers with acne, you could dramatically improve their acne by lowering the glycemic load of the diet and increasing the protein content of the diet. So we now have experimental evidence that substantiates the epidemiologic work that we've done, as well as the epidemiologic work that's been done at Harvard by Walt Willett and his group. And they actually implicated milk in acne, and Neil Mann's study, they failed to take milk out, so we think that they would have even done better by reducing the glycemic load, elevating protein, and eliminating milk from their diet.
Wow, that's massively interesting. It sounds fantastic. I believe you had a co-author with that book. Is it a female that wrote that book with you?
No, I actually wrote that one. That was one of the few books I wrote myself.
The Dietary Cure for Acne.
Yeah, so the second book, my co-author was Joe Friel with The Athletic book, and I wrote the first one myself. Second one I wrote completely myself as well. It's more like a booklet. It's not a full-blown book. I think it's about 30,000 words.
Okay, because I subscribe to FMU by Jeffrey Bland. I believe you've been a special guest of his.
I've gone up and I've spoken to his functional medicine group.
Okay, good, because I recently heard one of his interviews was with a female physician, I believe, a dermatologist, and she spoke and referred to your work.
Oh, well,
I thought there was a connection.
Yeah, we've actually published a couple of papers together as co-authors on the diet-acne connection, but she's written her separate book, and I've written one as well separately, but we've collaborated on a couple of scientific papers, and she's a very good colleague and co-author.
And what is her name?
It's Valerie Treloar.
Valerie Treloar. She was the name. I think she's a dermatologist, isn't she?
She's a dermatologist back east
yes.
in Massachusetts that's highly involved in the diet-acne connection, and she's had great success by taking her acne patients and having them follow the diet we recommend.
Well, that is wonderful news. I'll certainly do what I can to let people know about all of your books. And again, what was your website, Lorne?
www.thepaleodiet.com.
And I subscribe to your newsletter, which I find is really good updates and good information. So everybody out there who's listening, get to that website, thepaleodiet.com, subscribe to Lauren's newsletter, and get on side with this incredible information. Dr. Cordain, our time is gone, and thanks so much for your contribution. The work that you're doing is incredibly important. It's making a change. I followed one of the links on your last newsletter, and it brought me to, I believe, a show or a documentary about the perfect diet. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a public PBS documentary that is in the works right now, and they're just lacking a little bit of funding. But it's a pretty neat documentary, and hopefully this thing will get out and get the word out to a lot more people. But, Corey, I appreciate all the kind words that you've had to say about the diet and my research, and it's been my pleasure to be on your program.
Lauren Cordain, Ph.D., is a professor in the Department of Health and Exercise Science at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. Very well-respected researcher and author. Lauren, we thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Representing lifestyle, new way of life. Listen, it's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight, Malik with Sports Nutrition Update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHawley.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.